quick reminder, if you want to watch Melancholia with Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, 24th second, it's standardized on the DVD, 24th second of the film, start the album, and let the first song repeat at the end, which is the title song, Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness, so it acts as bookends to the film. So, check it out.
And I guess if anyone wanted to watch Thick as a Brick in the Wall, it's on Vimeo. You could just search it on Vimeo.
Watching Thick as a Brick in the Wall last night, I was noticing a few things. I was going to look it up, and maybe you know what year it was that Jethro Tull did Thick as a Brick 2.
It was pretty recent, and I could be wrong, but I think it might just be Ian Anderson without Jethro Tull.
Right.
I actually didn't know about Thick as a Brick 2 until I started this project. Basically, I was like, Thick as a Brick is 45 minutes long. What could fill in the rest of that time? And I found out there was a Thick as a Brick 2, and I was like, oh, cool.
So do you know the year difference between Jethro Tull's original Thick as a Brick and Pink Floyd's The Wall?
I do not.
I was kind of curious of it, because just, even if it's, you know, just in the ballpark, you know, it's interesting being that Roger Waters redid The Wall relatively recently, and just how it is that there's like, I don't know, I found that kind of,
So Thick as a Brick was 1972.
Okay.
Thick as a Brick 2 is 2012.
Okay. Yeah, so I feel like I saw Roger Waters' deal in 2012, didn't I? I mean, it seems like that's when he redid The Wall. I just found that correspondence kind of interesting. Just that you have, like, it's been revisited. They both revisited their albums. Essentially.
Yeah, yeah.
I was also I've noticed this before with The Wall. If you get the LP, the way it is that, you know, the whole thing is a wall. Like, you see the bricks, that's what the cover is, and it's on both sides. And you open up and there's a hole in the wall. Like, the bricks break apart. You ever own the record?
Yeah, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
So, and there's this kind of idea I had back when around, you know how at the very beginning of the record, the first thing you hear if you listen really closely is We Come In, and if you listen really closely at the very end of the whole record, you hear This Is Where. You know about that?
I don't think so.
So if you turn the volume way up at the end of the record, you hear This Is Where, I believe is Roger Waters, and then you can hear at the very, very beginning, We Come In. So it's meant to be a loop, just like, you know, I mean, you could argue that you're going to be listening to something on repeat, but, I mean, this is an LP, you know, you're going to start it at the beginning. There's like, it feels like there's more to it, you know, like, the heartbeat and Dark Side of the Moon, and the way that, you know, you got in Animals, you have Pigs on the Wing part one and part two, and they end on the same riff that they begin on. But basically just that loop factor, it feels like there's something to it. And so between, like, that felt like an interesting argument for the loop nature of, like, Jethro Tull's Thick as a Brick, is the way that it's, like, it's circular. So of course, like, I'm not claiming anything in terms of intentionality, but synchronistically, it makes a lot of sense on a certain level, because you have a loop that's introduced. So you're starting the album because of the newspaper, right? So you still started at the newspaper. So the newspaper goes across the screen, and Thick as a Brick has that newspaper on the front, and so you're starting it there. But then you're taking the last song, and you're making the last song on his new record first.
Okay, I'll go into the layout if you want real quick, but just to say, Thick as a Brick 2, so it is just Ian Anderson, and he wrote, according to Anderson, Thick as a Brick 2 focuses on Gerald Bostock, the fictional boy genius author of the original album, 40 years later. Quote, I wonder what the 8-year-old Gerald Bostock would be doing today. Would the fabled newspaper still exist? So I thought that's interesting there. Also, the fact that getting an echo here.
Yeah, getting here too.
Jason, are you with us?
Yeah, I'm here.
Awesome. There we okay. go. I'm going to ask you to just mute for 1 second. And
yeah.
Then so real quick to say, the other thing is that the Thick as a Brick original album cover obviously is a newspaper. It's black and white and has some red text in the upper left-hand corner. The Wall album, you obviously have the black and white wall with occasionally the red writing on it. So it's sort of like that old joke, what's black and white and red all over?
Uh-huh, totally.
So there's even like the color coding seems really, really appropriate to match these. But so on Thick as a Brick 1, what happens is they had to split it in half because of, the way a record works, you have to flip it. So there's this sequence where they, halfway through the album, they have this sort of wind sound, and then they start off with this music that kind of fades out and then fades back in. Well, Thick as a Brick 2 starts with the same wind and music that the second side of the original Thick as a Brick starts with. So they actually, like, sample that music or replay it or whatever. So what I ended up doing was splitting the original Thick as a Brick in half into its two halves. So going side one, and then where side two would come in, since the same music is what starts Thick as a Brick 2, I put that in there. So it's almost like I split the original album in half and dropped the sequel in the middle, because musically it's kind of the same thing, mm-hmm. that it would start the same way. So that's how I laid it out.
That's awesome. Yeah, I think it's actually more appropriate that it's not entirely Jethro Tull, being that it wasn't entirely Pink Floyd.
Right,
you know
right,
what
right.
I mean? Like, it's just, I don't know, I feel like there's something to, like, because you're like, wow, that's a long time to have in between for the, you know what I mean? For the, like, you couldn't have done this at any other time until the last 2 years.
Yeah, exactly. And like I said, I didn't even know the new album existed until I was doing this.
Well,
and the original album I love. I've probably listened to this album thousands and thousands of times. No exaggeration. Like, it's one of my favorite albums, the original Thick as a Brick. Mm-hmm. And so it just sort of, the sequel does not stand up the same way, and it doesn't speak to me the same way, but still very interesting.
Totally. There's a part in it where it's the introduction of the court section when he's going mm-hmm. to court, and when the bathroom door opens, and it's in Thick as a Brick 2, I believe, because they say mm-hmm. 2 actually in the song. So right when it says Thick as a Brick and the door opens, that for me in the whole film was like the most spot on moment. Like, it's because it's like the wall forms out of that. Like, all of a sudden, you know, do you know what I'm saying? Like, the wall shows
sure,
up right after that. It's like felt like really poignant. Let's welcome.
I think there's the. Oh, yeah, okay. I just. Sure. I'd say the probably most poignant point for me is when the kid is in the wall movie, the kid is trying on his father's uniform and he's singing about the young men of the country have all gone into service. And just the whole thing is about sort of like these children becoming soldiers is what he's singing about, as the what you're watching on the screen is the kid putting on his father's military uniform. That's one of the things that stands out most to me.
Totally.
Yeah, but please, let's bring Jason.
Jason.
How you doing, sir?
I'm here. Hi.
Your microphone sounds pretty good.
Does it?
I think so. It sounds a whole lot better than that, like, snow blizzard that we've heard the last two times we've tried to have you on here. So, it's awesome.
Well, is there an echo now with the audio? Because these headphones bleed a lot.
Well,
they're very open.
I was hearing the echo when I said something, but I don't hear anything now. No,
okay.
It sounds perfect.
Yeah, I think we're good. So...
I take it you got the headset that I sent you.
Yes, thank you. It was called Dragon Speaking, so I was a little superstitious of it.
Now you have to speak with the tongue of a dragon.
Right.
Huh.
Hearing and speaking.
I was just
reptile-like.
Thinking of that guy that got his tongue surgically split, who's got like tattooed scales all over his body. Have you seen him before?
Is that the Enigma or someone else?
It's the forked tongue. It always one side speaks lies and the other side speaks truth.
Right.
Like a double phoenix.
Right. Which is like, I took that as really fitting of the way that the serpent is first described in the garden as Arum, which is cunning and naked. So Adam and Eve are the most are naked and not ashamed. And then it introduces the serpent, who's the most cunning of all the creatures. And it's the same word. I took that as like the forked tongue, that you're like, it's truth because it's exposed, but because nobody sees it, it becomes cunning.
Exactly.
Totally. So we wanted you on the show in the first place just to have you on because you're awesome. And we also wanted to talk about Melancholia a little bit.
Yes.
I don't know if you ever got the chance to see my crazy Melancholia.
I got through half of it. Before I had to go to bed.
Oh, but you
but
saw
I,
it with the music.
With the music, yes.
Nice. What'd you think?
It was interesting. I'm the kind of guy who always just likes to watch the movie and like pick apart at what everyone's saying, because I'm kind of ADD like that.
Sure.
So it's just a different thing for me to try to go into this kind of sensory overload where you've got the music and the movie playing in synchronicity like that.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I know I don't have the movie memorized per se, but I've seen it a few times now with the sound, and I'm like, I know what they're saying here. So I guess that's like, I feel weird watching a movie with music if I've never fucking seen the movie before. That's what is kind of challenging for me sometimes, because I'm like, what the fuck is going on? And so when I've shown it to people, I've tried to make it a point for them to at least know the plot first. Otherwise, you're like, who's that guy? What is he doing there? Whatever, you know. But yeah, no, I'm glad you got to do that. I remember seeing a post from you after I had seen Melancholia and looked at the date, and it was like right when it showed up in the theaters, meaning you had gone to see that in the theater.
No, I had downloaded bootleg.
Oh,
screener.
Gotcha. Well, we'll...
Because I'm poor.
I guess Bill had seen it in the theater. I guess that was my confusion. Yes.
I don't support the Hollywood Babylon system, you see.
Right.
I'm bleeding against time. By recontextualizing the images, I heard to turn their own weapons against themselves.
Yeah. I don't know. I appreciate Lars von Trier's work in the first place, and approaching Melancholia, I found it very helpful to have seen Antichrist first and foremost, and also like Dogville, very insightful into what's being communicated. So if you wanted to make certain arguments for what's going on in the movie, those other films that he did feel like real clues as to what the symbolism represents. What do you think of some of the particulars around that? Do you have any thoughts?
Well, I didn't see Antichrist a little later. And I don't know, it's kind of doing its own thing, but it's at the same time, you've got the two Christ figures in these various movies. So in Dogville, the Christ figure is Nicole Kidman, and then in Melancholia, it's Kirsten Dunst, and then in Antichrist, it is Willem Dafoe, of course.
Right.
And so, but then you've got, so then you've got this repeating pattern where on one hand it's this blonde girl, on the other hand it's the bearded man who is all virile masculinity, as these two figures sort of representing like this higher spirit principle versus the material element in which it is embodied when it becomes flesh and walks among us.
Well, so I haven't seen either Antichrist or Dogville, but I did watch Melancholia just before, actually in the airport heading out to see David, and then watching it a second time the same day with the album. Mm-hmm. I took some notes of some of the things that stood out to me. I'm just curious to run some of these things by you. Some of it seemed like really intentional, and some of it just extra things to read into here. And one of them deals with the horse crossing the bridge, which David told me is actually in, is it Antichrist?
Yeah, with the same woman who's not Justine, but Claire. So Claire, who's a character in Melancholia, her role in Antichrist, she has to cross this small bridge that's very similar to the bridge in Melancholia, and she's hesitating. What were you asking, Jason? What did he say? Oh, he was asking about the bridge in Antichrist.
Yes, the bridge.
So
bridge into the underworld.
Right. I found it really it was like in Antichrist, it felt like a very like Clefotic version of Eden, because everything was kind of reversed. Yes. It's like this dark substitute Eden.
It's a dark paradise, man.
Yeah, and so if you transfer that over to what's happening in Melancholia, where she's beating the horse to cross the bridge and it won't cross, the parallel seems pretty uncanny. And so it's like, you know, and it's Abraham. So she's beating Abraham, saying go back to Eden, and he won't go. He won't cross the line. He'd rather stay. Or maybe it's the reversal. I don't know. However you want to take it, I guess. It's an open symbol, but I don't know. I found that really interesting. Did you notice that when you watched those?
I forgot about that. I forgot about any bridge in Melancholia. You notice that it. So in the one film we have Kirsten Dunst going to Charlotte Gainsbourg, and then in the other is Willem Dafoe going to reconnect with Charlotte Gainsbourg in the woods. Again, there's that parallel there where she is the Magdalene of narrative, who lives in this sort of fallen nature world, as either her sister or a lover, and these things are kind of the same.
Right.
Okay. Speaking of sister or lover, same thing. What do you think of the father in Melancholia who has the two Bettys? So it's like
yes.
Betty. He's like Betty and Betty, which I couldn't help but think of.
Plus, he doesn't have a spoon. You know, there's no spoon.
Oh, there is no Matrix. Spoon. Yeah, there is no.
And he's Winston Smith from.
Exactly.
1984.
Yeah. That's interesting.
But this is the whole pattern with Dunst, where she enters into this sort of like fallen world, or also with this other blonde character, Nicole Kidman, where she sort of enters into this other world and then it all kind of goes to hell. Where this new element is introduced into this kind of dysfunctional family unit. And that's a pattern in a lot of films.
Huh.
I was thinking of Betty and Betty as, if I have this correct, isn't Beth in Hebrew, Beth is house?
Bait is house, yeah.
So it's like the two houses, like the house divided?
Yeah, it means house of bread? No. That's
Bethlehem.
Bethlehem, but it's the same root, right?
So, yeah.
And Bethany is the place that Jesus goes to after Lazarus. So the resurrection of the dead.
Well, there's two girls, so it's water. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's almost like, hey, LBJ.
Hmm. I was just, as soon as you said the comment about him being in 1984, I couldn't help but think of the 2 + 2 = 5 deal with all the rats in the cage where they're trying to get. Oh, wow, that's fucking awesome.
All my rage.
That's that scene. So the scene where he's collecting the spoons is, despite all my rage, I am still just a rat in a cage, gets played during that. And he's got the fucking rats in the cage on his face in 1984. And
despite all his rage, he still becomes the prime minister in V for Vendetta.
Totally.
Well, yeah, it's like he's fighting himself, man.
Wow, that's
the guy in prison and the guy on the dictator.
That's deep. Huh.
Totally, dude.
All right, so let me throw some other stuff at you here. So, obviously, we have the idea of Eden. It seems like very, very obvious. Like even like who's marrying Kirsten Dunst offers her an apple farm. So here we have the representation of Eden. That seemed like really explicit.
Yeah, the apple farm is great because they're Empire apples.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
So he wants to live a life in the Empire and, you know, eat Empire apples and have a normal little day world life. But Kirsten Dunst isn't going to stand for that.
So if it's the Empire is Malkuth. And here she's bringing this higher sphere, if we want to consider it that, or this other sphere.
She's the Kabbalistic light of Ein Sof Or turning into the dark world.
Well, exactly right. So I'm saying, so he's offering her Earth, and she's saying, for me to come to Earth means bringing this heaviness, this light, but this almost destructive light of...
Right, she has to reject what he is offering, his apples.
Right. Do you consider that like a Snow White apple, like the sleeping apple?
Yeah, definitely. So in this case, it's Adam offering that apple.
Exactly, yeah. So I thought that was pretty explicit. But then I thought was something that was really nicely sort of disguised was there's that scene where you see Claire and Justine and the little boy Leo, of course being the lion.
Yes.
They do, it was essentially a first degree tracing board, right? You have the three, you have like the sun and the moon and then Melancholia in the sky, with the three sort of pillars at the center.
Yeah, and then we just had that news story about the two girls dressing as the Twin Towers.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It's the same thing.
Yeah.
And with Leo being strength.
Yes. The lion child of his mother.
But now bear in mind, so he's in that shot, he's in the center. And later in the movie we see that same sort of shot, but instead of the child being there, there's a pillar with a sundial on top of it. And with the idea of the horse being named Abraham, I couldn't help but think that was the sun atop the altar. Right? You have a sundial on top of this pillar. So Abraham, the sun on the altar, and this is the whole idea. Like,
yeah, but instead, of course, it's Kiefer Sutherland who sacrifices himself.
See, I feel like Kiefer Sutherland becomes Abraham. This is something Dave and I talked about, because he dies in Abraham's stall, right? Like, he goes into the horse's stall to die.
And then she takes out Abraham, as if to imply, you know, that it's a role reversal. kind of weird. It was just an idea, and I'm, I could probably look
at it. Well, what I'm saying is that if Abraham is the horse, but Kiefer Sutherland kind of trades places with the horse, it's what it's implying is that Leo is the son of Abraham. And he is Leo the lion, the son, or the sundial on the altar.
Marketing out time.
Absolutely, yeah.
Saturn.
There was, there's another little thing here, like all the serious symbolism that seems to follow Kirsten Dunst around. The fact that there's even, there's a shot where she's standing next to a picture on the wall, and it's a picture of a giraffe. Mm-hmm. And Richard Arrowsmith has done all the stuff connecting the giraffe to Sirius. And even though Melancholy in this case is a blue planet, I couldn't help but think of it as being another sort of version of the blue star. The
Sirius black.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, here's something. There's a scene where I guess it's the girl Claire, she goes onto her email, and instead of like Gmail, it's like Wmail. I guess it's like webmail or something, but you change the G to a W. But in doing so, the letter G is 7, right? It's the 7th letter, and W is the 23rd letter. So you've encoded your 723.
First day of dog days.
Right.
For our listeners.
So I thought that was an interesting little nod. Again, I don't know if that's intentional or not, but another interesting nod to Sirius in this film. Now, my question to David, and I don't know if you've had a chance to look at it since then, but I'm going to pose this question to you, Jason. There is a scene where Kiefer Sutherland puts the suicide pills in this drawer, and he hides this key on a bookshelf. Have either of you zoomed in? Because I feel like if I was a guy like Lars von Trier hiding all this stuff, and then you say, here's the key, and you put it on the bookshelf, is there not something to be found? A sort of key to unlock some of the symbolism of the film. Has anyone actually zoomed in to see what book that key is hidden behind or anything like that?
I have not, so I will leave you to investigate that.
Awesome, okay.
Because I'm afraid that this will crash if I do anything.
Yeah, that's cool. Well then, let me ask... one more question. I don't know if you can kind of picture it in your mind, but still on the idea of the Sirius star, there's this one scene where Kirsten Dunst is laying nude on this kind of shoreline, bathing in the light of Melancholia. And I asked David, I said, do you think that's supposed to be emblematic of the star tarot card, where she essentially has like 1 foot on the land, 1 foot in the water. She topless, just and then this sort of glowing light behind her. Do you think that's emblematic of the star card? And he said, well, look at her leg position. I see it more as a hanged man. Would you see a reason to kind of, does that do anything for you with the symbolism you've noticed in the film?
For me?
Yeah.
The hanged man would actually make more sense given her Christ archetype.
The mem in Hangman makes me feel like it should be a woman.
Right.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it's the water. Like, I don't know. I've always associated that card with
feminine. And if you noticed on the Hangman card, he has kind of a golden halo around his head, which would be, you know, golden hair.
Mm-hmm.
So that would make sense.
What do you think of the fact that Kiefer Sutherland is the he's not the head, ultimate head vampire in The Lost Boys, but he's like the secondary. It's really poignant when you're watching it with the album and it says, the world is a vampire, cut to Kiefer Sutherland. That's just nice. But that, you know, in The Lost Boys, you have the woman named Star, and Kiefer Sutherland's name is David. And so it's Star of David. I just saw the other day that Jeremy made that same connection. I made that same connection. It's an obvious connection, but
Well, it's the Bram Stoker's Dracula connection again, where Dracula, the vampire, has to eventually sacrifice himself for his love.
Right. I never know.
And again, so the key is the suicide.
Well, exactly. And this is why when I had been waiting to see this pairing of the movie and the film, what I was really curious on the album Melancholy and Infinite Sadness, I hope we can just jump straight in, but did you mention this? What we're talking about here is David Plait does a combination of Smashing Pumpkins, Melancholy and Infinite Sadness over the film Melancholia. I don't know if we've made that clear. Just throwing that out there. On the album, there is a song where he repeatedly sings, "Love is Suicide." And for me, I was really interested to see where that song landed.
The first opening of that song is right when they show Melancholia, the planet, for the first time.
Right.
When she looks up and she's like, whoa. And it comes in all like, you know, makes this really kind of like intense sound right when the planet shows up. And then it plays for the transition from part one of Claire to part two, Justine. And,
exactly. It's playing over the thing where she's trying to get the horse over the bridge. And
the dark horse.
The dark horse. Well, exactly. So obviously, you know, when I'm writing this thing, Suicide Kings, I'm thinking of it in terms of JFK, at least for part of it. And, you know, with the JFK thing, there's, of course, John F. Kennedy, who everyone calls Jack, his wife, Jackie, and then there's Jack Ruby. And I felt like there needed to be a fourth Jack to complete the sort of the cards that seemed to be implied. Well, there is a fourth Jack when JFK's body is led through the streets of D.C. It's pulled by a black horse. The horse's name is Black Jack, and it's the funeral horse. It is the sort of pallbearer funeral horse. And in this case, so hearing that song while looking at this black horse, thinking of Black Jack, his name is Abraham, all this sort of stuff, I'm thinking of it in those kind of terms, but it's almost like he's the ferryman. You know, he's what's carrying her over to the underworld, which is what you said, Jason, the idea that this was the bridge to the underworld. But the fact that the ferryman, being the horse, wouldn't carry her over, it seemed to imply, like almost like, it's not your time yet. Like, you're ready to die, but it's not yet time for you to die. And as I'm thinking this, her section ends. So it's like, you're not ready to die, but your story's over. Because the first half of the film is Justine, the second half of the film is Claire. And as I'm thinking, oh, it's not yet time for her to die. Her time isn't up yet. It's like, but her time is up.
What do you think of, like, you know, in Crowley's deck, the knight is the highest. As if to say that, you know, change is the basis for stability and not the other way around. So instead of the king sitting on the throne being like, oh, look what I've accomplished, it's still in movement.
But I think the message there is that there aren't any kings, there are only queens.
Right. Okay, so that brings us
which is reflected in the English monarchy at the moment.
Right, and it's completely reflected in the film Melancholia very, very directly. But, okay, right now I got out Crowley's classic book on magic, trying to see. Okay, so the four knights, Horst, are connected to Chokmah on his tree. The four queens are related to Bina, with the empress in between them. Do you think you could take it that the knights are trying to cross, that the bridge might actually be the
yeah,
pool?
Yeah, yeah, you could actually say that Kirsten Dunst is Chokmah. Because she's luminosity, and then the whole villa that they inhabit is Bina as space.
So isn't it kind of trippy that that's the highest spherot up to Keter? And so it's like her not being able to cross that bridge is like her not being able to make it to the crown, so to speak?
Yeah.
I mean, it's just a thought, but it's kind of interesting.
And like, yeah, it's a good thought.
Huh.
But I think she is actually headed towards Bina, because it will be the omega point of the Kabbalistic system.
Mm-hmm.
And then we will call in upside down. She actually lives in the upper world, opposing the lower world that we inhabit.
Totally. Isn't it interesting that in Antichrist, you know, the way that it's written out is always with that Venus symbol as the T? You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So like the T of Antichrist, which you would associate with the cross, but then, and the way I've taken it is just that it's a joke on like that the it's a feminine symbol to equate the.
Well, yeah. Well, Charlotte Gainsbourg again is the tree is the cross that he's going to get nailed to.
But yeah, exactly. Quite literally. Exactly. Totally. And that's the arms of the cross. I mean, the cross of the tree. So where the cross shows up on the tree of life is due to the intersection of Venus with the moon. So Gimel and Dalet form the cross. And so that's between Chochmah and Bina. But isn't that interesting that that's the very thing that's dividing it? I mean, I just find that really great, that it's like he's got this film Antichrist all about trying to get back to Aiden, but it's this like all the shells are like in the way of the holiness. And that
Right. So there's Doth in between getting from Chochmah to Bina.
Yeah.
Can you explain for me that you're saying the actress who plays Claire
is
the same actress as in Antichrist? What is her role, like plot-wise? What is her role?
There's only three characters in the entire film of Antichrist, and it's him and her and Nick. So their little kid dies at the beginning, and that's Nick. And so her is Claire. Him is The Last Temptation of Christ, William Dafoe. So.
But I'm asking, like, in the actual story, what is her, just like
she's like the Mary Magdalene to his Jesus.
Okay, because I thought that and he's the dark Jesus, right? He's the Antichrist. Because you have even
not specifically in that film. He's the hero who triumphs. Over her unruly nature
on a certain level. Because
it's an ironic sort of thing for von Trier, I think.
But then at the end, you have all the people, all the witches, you're supposed to take it, which all represent the femininity, still rule over him. Because he's like, I've gotten rid of her. And then it's like, no, there's the, you know.
Well, it's the circumcision again that you talk about. So, like, Charlotte circumcises herself, and then all of the dead girls are able to come back to life.
Oh, you connect that.
I guess what I'm asking is, like, it seems pretty obvious that in even the names of the two women in Melancholia, Justine being a sort of justice, like the pillar of severity, and Claire being, like, perhaps clarity or something like that.
It's actually reversed from what we would imagine it would be since...
Right. And I'm asking, does she carry the same archetype into Antichrist, or is it another reversal?
I would say that Charlotte is pretty much the same character in both.
Okay.
I'm just going to use their real names.
That's right. Okay.
There's a really great point just watching it with the music where it says Justine never knew the rules in the song 1979, and she's working with the harness of Abraham, as it says it, hung down with the freaks and ghouls. Can't remember the line exactly, but it says, "I know you better than you fake it to see," and it's just it's so like it was very affirming for me because I'd watched the album with the film a few times before I even caught that, and I'm like, how do I mean, Justine's not that common of a name, so that was pretty fucking specific, so I I don't know. You know that the tree in Antichrist where the bird falls out of it and it's covered with ants?
Mm-hmm.
What do you... I don't know. What do you think of that? Because the tree itself is like the... it's like a dying tree.
Well, right. He's into a Sierra Negredo and everything's kind of falling apart and dying.
But if it's a dying tree and there's ants in it, those are probably carpenter ants.
Ah.
Nice. Those are the carpenters eating away at the newborn.
But again, what I find interesting is how Charlotte in Antichrist says nature is Satan's church. So then he draws this pyramid where you know, he puts nature and then he crosses it out and puts me on it. So the inference is clearly that Charlotte Gainsbourg is nature. And this is her church, and it's Satan's church.
Right, but you could take it either way, and that was kind of the beauty of that. Because when he puts me, you could take that as herself is the immediate response, but you could just as easily take it that it's him.
Exactly.
So, and that he's part of her. And so she's like repressing that aspect of herself, perhaps, or the reversal. You could take things so many different ways. It's crazy.
In Melancholia, Kirsten Dunst says, the world is evil. I think she says, the world is evil, right? And then the Claire, who's the mother of the child, she says, like, but where is Leo going to grow up? Meaning, so like, she's definitely the embodiment of nature. She's the womb for the child. Like, where is the child right. grow up? But in the mother.
Right.
So, you know, so she's saying there has to be a sort of earthly realm so that we can have this womb.
Right. And then Leo talks about building the caves with Kirsten Dunst, which is to build the temple of the cosmos, which has not been properly been done up to that point. The creation of the cosmos up to that point was an error, a mistake. And so now they have to rebuild it to their own specifications, which is the building of the cave at the end of the film.
So
how would you relate that? Like, because when he kept saying wanting to make a cave, I couldn't help but think of Plato's cave. But
right. Well, the cave represents the cosmos to Plato. So that's where it comes into play here. So it's like it's Charlotte Gainsbourg's cosmos as because she's like space, and then Kirsten Dunst is a luminosity that enters into cosmos, and then builds the cave.
Nice. Okay, so she's the womb, and the child basically wants to go back into the womb of the cosmos, but he needs to bring the light back in and back in with him.
Right. We need to have Kirsten Dunst there to bring the light, and to bring harmony to all these discordant and sort of evil character types that are all fighting inside of the villa.
Hmm. Gotcha. That makes a lot of sense.
So, with the album film interplay, the most like, okay, so the moment at which the child opens the computer, when he picks up the computer to see Melancholia's Dance of Death, it repeats over and over again, suffer my desire for you. As he sits down next to Justine, who's in the bed. So she's,
well, she's also in Nymphomaniac.
The his newest film?
Yeah.
Okay.
It's info.
I'm really I'm looking forward to that like crazy. Just that idea that literally why it's called Melancholia in the first place, beyond, you know, the black vial of the alchemist and all of that, but just that it's her pain. So she's experiencing this pain, and she's actually like honing in the planet. Like, she's bringing the planet in, and it's for the child who's so innocent, it's literally saying, and he's looking at this screen of Melancholia's Dance of Death. Like, I don't know, I felt like really like what it came down to in a way was that everyone was kind of suffering her desire for them, like because of what she's gone through or what she's going through.
Well, right, so who does a Dance of Death but Kali? And you have this idea that what you have to do, and this is I think what Jason was saying, but sort of sacrificing yourself is what you ultimately have to do is to lay down and surrender to Kali as she dances over you, right, in her Dance of Death. So there's that aspect. But again, there's this implied sexuality, which I was sort of trying to wrap my head around, because even the first scene where you see him, the young boy Leo, and Kirsten Dunst's character, when the first time you see them interact, the kid pulls out a knife.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't help but think of Funeral Parade of Roses and The Shining, the idea of this being the sort of, you know, murder weapon phallus, this sort of implied, almost incestuous nature of...
It could be circumcision.
Okay, you're saying, again, I guess because at the end he's using the knife to make the stabs.
The circumcision is the removal of the cleat boat, which is the whole point of the destruction of the planet, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm. Right, right. So it has to be replaced with the archetypal version of the world.
Well,
in the Gnostic sense.
Yeah.
Or Platonic sense.
So there is, throughout the film, I think it was David Kirby, if I'm wrong, I think it was just maybe an hour or so before we watched the film, I was sitting on your couch with Melissa, my wife, and we pulled out your Thoth deck, and we each pulled a card. And I believe she pulled the Eight of Wands, which is swiftness.
Yes.
Just sort of the eight compass points. And we had a bit of a conversation about that. Now, in the film, you'll notice that the Dance of Death, it shows an eight-pointed cycle that the planet will take. It shows you eight steps, but there's an implied ninth because it's the eighth step, and then the ninth point, even though it's not marked, would be the cataclysm. Now, at the end of the film, they have the cave that they build has eight. It's made of eight staves, okay? It's your eight wands. But then Kirsten Dunst pulls in a ninth as the door. So you won't not only have the ninth gate, okay? You have literally that the nine of wands is strength, is Leo in the Thoth deck.
Nine of wands is Sagittarius strength. It's the moon in Sagittarius, right?
Right, but the kid's name is Leo. He is the lion. He is strength.
Right, right, right.
So I'm saying by her pulling in that ninth wand, she's literally they're getting into the Crowleian strength card with Leo, their strength. So you have this sort of 8 to 9 repeated thing that I noticed throughout, really culminating in it at the end. Now I found we went the next day. We went to Justin Morgan's house, and he had this quasi-alchemical piece on his wall when you first walk into the house. It's definitely based on a Robert Flood illustration, but it had been redone and stuff like that. And it shows the zodiac and the different cycles, and you know the idea of like what is this planet, what is this sign aligned to, and stuff like that. And what I thought was interesting is that it has a 12-step cycle for each part of the zodiac. And Scorpio was the eighth part of the cycle. Here's that number eight again. Scorpio was the eighth part of the cycle, that part being death. It's associated with melancholy, a la Melancholia, and that when they first notice Melancholia, they notice it because it's blocking out part of the constellation Scorpio.
That's huge.
I think Kali is right there in Melancholia's name. So.
Yes. Yeah.
I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, that's amazing. And then, so it appears in Scorpio. That's what they say at the beginning. You were saying, because I didn't remember that. I thought it was
just Judas the backstabber.
Oh, shit. Yeah, purgation and purgatory. And it's totally like a purgatory realm that they seem to be in. I mean, that's how I can't help but take it, both with Antichrist and Dogville, for that matter. Dogville is huge. Because Dogville is like, it's so obvious. It's like the Zohar in a play form. Like
She cleanses the whole world with fire, right?
Yeah, it's too much. It's too perfect. It's all too perfect with that one. And then when she's in the truck with the apples and the snake, like it's ridiculous. I want to mention something really quick, and that's the reason why I wanted to play these two together in the first place was because of Durer's etching of Melancholia 1. And just looking at that, I'm like, well, both places are drawing their inspiration from the first place, which is what seemed to be happening. Like, that seems to be why Melancholy and the Infinite Sadness and Melancholia.
Yeah, and then on the Durer illustration, you have the uncut stone that needs to be worked, which is, again, the whole thing with building the cave in Melancholia.
Ooh, I didn't think of that. That's good.
I like how the Smashing Pumpkins album actually breaks it down. It's not the word melancholy, but it's like a name, like melon space Kali. And as Jason just said, Kali being embedded in the name, the Smashing Pumpkins almost make that more clear.
Yeah, and if somebody wanted to make the argument that Kali is often spelled with a K, who the fuck cares, because it's Sanskrit. It's what it sounds
or,
like. Not what
or
it
a Kali like. Is a dog. Your dog star Sirius or Dogville.
Ooh, that's good. Because there's all the... Oh, God, that's really good. That didn't even occur to me. It's funny. Amy's parents' dog is named Kali. And it's a Kali. But, okay, so, you know, like, right when it starts part two, Claire, you'll see in the window... I believe it's 5x5. Whatever it is, it's the equivalent of what the Jupiter square is, the magic square. So the window has sections. It's a squared window. It's got squares within a square. And they show you very, like, directly. And it's got circles in between at each joint. So you're looking at a 5x5 magic square. And then right after that, it shows you another 5x5 square with the candies that she takes the one from the bottom row, and she puts it, or I guess it could argue be the top row, because if you look at what's actually written on the candies, it's facing up. I think it's three.
But if she's the hangman, she would have to be looking at it upside down.
Right. Everything's upside down.
She was in upside down.
That's right. Well, Claire takes it. But she puts it onto Justine's pillow. And then if you look closely, you'll see Justine had taken it off of her pillow when she was laying in her bed and set it on the nightstand. But just the fact that you're looking at this magic square, which is the same amount of squares as Dürer's Melancholia 1, I checked. So the square that's, you know, the classic Dürer magic square is the same. So you're like, there's no question. I mean, there shouldn't be a question anyway that that's the premise of the whole movie is Melancholia 1 by Dürer. But mm-hmm. that the square is if you could argue that it was a coincidence that it shows up once, it happens 2 seconds later again. And so, I don't know, he really made a point to show you what he's communicating there. And it's partly, it seems to just be however you slice it, it's still going to be the same thing as the meaning of the square in the first place. Cut
yeah,
it this way.
And just the straight, the Kabbalistic Tree of Life shows up in Handicraft too, doesn't it?
Does it? I don't know. I don't remember.
I think it does at some point where it's on the window.
Oh, that's right. There is. Yes, it is. Completely. Yeah, and I think they even have maybe even different, they're like stones, right? There's like these mm-hmm. little, yeah, it's in perfect formation. There's the Tree of Life on the window that he's, it's a window that he there's by the bed, right? He sticks his hand out the window and gets it covered in these little fucking things. I don't know what they are. I've never seen them. I mean, I've been in the woods. I never had those, whatever those things were that were crawling, all that were stuck to his hand. They're like the equivalent of leeches or something. He has to pull them all off. But yeah, I think it was that window. It was like he sticks his hand through the window. And the fact that it's on the window in the first place, which is, you know, hey. So, this, mm-hmm. you know, which you could argue is the star or the emperor, if you want to go the European route. But just that he sticks his hand out the window and he gets something that's sucking his energy or sucking his life.
Right.
You know, like that's very symbolic and direct. So, interesting.
So I was pointing out that final sequence, the very final shot of the film when they're sitting inside the cave, is representing another alchemical etching, and that being that of the Philosopher's Stone, where you see the philosopher with a compass tracing a circle. You have a circle, a mm-hmm. triangle, a square, and then you have the alchemical marriage taking place inside. You guys know which
yes.
one I'm talking
oh,
about?
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So if you look, they are, there's the circle that is formed by Melancholia approaching. They are sitting inside, even though it's like a cone-shaped pyramid, the angle at which you're seeing, they're inside the triangle. They're sitting in a circle holding hands, making another circle. And then it's like the union of the two halves of the sisters essentially being the same kind of split person being united in the center. Mm-hmm. So I just going with the idea that that seemed to me probably pretty intentional, that he's using these etchings as the...
Right. Another intentional thing, I think, is how they try to coax the tagline from Kirsten Dunst, which goes to getting the master's word from Hiram Abiff.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
That ties into building the cave as building the temple.
Wait a minute. Explain that to me. I didn't completely follow that.
The advertiser guy wants to get the tagline from Kirsten Dunst.
Yes.
And so he gets his assistant to try to coax it out of her,
uh-huh.
which is the three ruffians in the Masonic legend that try to get the word of the Master Mason from Hiram Abiff.
Oh, that's right. And so they those are the guys who stab him to death?
Right. But it's kind of inverted in this one.
Right.
But it's still it's a metaphorical death. It's melancholy.
Sure.
That's so fucking perfect, though, because I've pointed out that I think the name Abiff actually encodes circling the square.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that, squaring the circle. I have that backwards. okay, if you take the degrees of a circle, 360 degrees, and you actually square that, meaning 360 times 360, okay, that will give you 129,600. If you just simple switch those alphanumerics over, 1 becomes A, 2 becomes B, 9 becomes I, 6 becomes F. So by squaring the degrees of a circle, you get a biff.
That's so good.
So the fact that they're trying to get that out of her, making her... thus, if you're saying them trying to get the tagline out of her is putting her in correspondence with Hiram in that case, that the fact that at the end she actually would manage to complete this sort of squaring.
Mm-hmm. And she works in the advertising industry. So again, there's that going from like the Empire Garden to this other garden.
Hmm. You know, the very fact that, okay, this is kind of weird. So I started at the 24th second after, like, I imagine somewhere around 16 times of viewing it through. It was a huge process. Amy went to San Francisco, and I watched it over and over and over and over again, trying to find the best timing. And so I came up with the 24th second is how I got all the things that I wanted to align to actually align, and it blew my fucking mind on a personal level. But I found it really interesting after that, looking at, okay, well, the film is in DCP, which incidentally are my initials, but that's unrelated because I'm not going to personalize that. But so the digital format is 24 frames per second, which is standard for digital films that are, you know, being projected. And so it's interesting then that it would be the 24th second, because that implies 24 times 24. And then obviously, what's his name? The vampire, Kiefer Sutherland, it stars in the show 24 and Touch, which Touch is about synchronicity and 24 is about I don't know what, but that felt like, because especially for the fact that that's after the fact. So like I see that and I'm like, wow, I found the clue afterwards.
And as I've noticed that even though the show was just called Touch, their artwork was, all the artwork for the show was composed of touching squares. It's the squares that touch, and they are thus making it like the magic square of the melancholy etching or those windows, etc.
You know what I see when I see the Dance of Death is I see Stan Tenen's work of the donut shape, the thing that's the actual core of the apple. So you know how it curls around? You know what I'm talking about? I'm sure you probably know what mm-hmm. I'm talking about. So it's like he's explaining that that the Hebrew alphabet is a flame alphabet, and so he produces this flame which fits into a torus. I just really like the idea of its Dance of Death being like encompassing the sphere, like it's literally like curling back around, because it's kind of a spiral, because it goes by and it doesn't go all the way, and then it comes back around and then it hits it. It reminds me of that. Kind of an interesting little thought.
It's going to take me like a year to process that.
But you hear what I'm saying, though. You know what I'm talking about. I mean, I can prop a link up if you're not familiar with his, with Stan Tennant's work. Have you seen what I'm
talking
about?
No, I know what you're saying.
Oh, okay. It's just a little mind-blowing. Yeah.
So I'm probably not telling you guys anything you don't know, but just pointing out the Empress card, which is door, since the last thing Kirsten Dunst does is put the door on the cave, Empress is the path of Daleth, meaning door. Her planet is Venus, also called the gateway to heaven. Transitional state. Yeah, okay, so blah, blah, blah. But the idea that Venus, are you guys saying I should probably just watch the fucking movie and stop asking you questions, but in Antichrist, are you saying the Venus figure is Willem Dafoe, or are you saying it is the character Claire in Melancholia? Who do you think the Venus is?
Well, Venus is the morning star, and I was taking it that you could go either way, and that's the fucking beauty of it in the first place. That you can take it this way or you can take it that way, and there's no direct answer, though Jason might feel differently.
I'm so confused by the tarot these days that I've just forgotten all of it.
Oh, but I mean, just in terms of, like, when you see the title of Antichrist and you have that T, which is supposed to be Tav, mm-hmm. right? So you have the universe is associated here with Venus in the sense, like, mm-hmm. is that Claire, or is that her, or is that him?
It's the conjunction of both of them as a squared circle.
Okay, thank you. There we go. See, that's why we need to have you on the show more.
Awesome. And I liked how you pointed out, Jason, that even the sign of Venus is in itself a conjunction, where it is Mercury, was it Mercury and the Moon, sort of coming together to make that symbol?
Without the crescent. So, like, Mercury is a composite of three symbols. You have the sun. It was often represented with a dot in the middle of the circle, right? So you have the sun.
That's Chandi's hieroglyph.
Originally?
We put all of them together.
That I thought that predated John D. No, isn't that like a doesn't that alchemical?
The Mercury symbol with the circumpunct is.
Oh, with
John
the D's. Okay, good to know. I wasn't aware of that. I should know, because I mean I have it tattooed on my arm, but there's no dot in it. But anyways, that aside, I still take that circle to be the sun. Like, it just feels like that was the point, and that the crescent on top is the moon, and that the cross is the earth. Does that feel appropriate? So
sure.
So if you look at Venus, then you have the sun and the earth, if I'm not mistaken. Or are you taking that circle in this case of Venus to be the moon?
I think the circle is meant to be spirit, and the cross is matter.
Okay.
And so Venus would be like spirit over matter.
I could see that. Well, that's really interesting.
So I've heard.
Yeah, I've seen a few different things like that, where it's each of these symbols is showing a placement of where you can kind of make these symbols out of crescents, suns, crosses, and that it's showing a sort of placement or hierarchy.
You know, there's this whole thing about, you know, that large stone that's in Jerusalem that they say was the foundation of Solomon's temple that everyone goes to check out, and they say it's where Jacob had his vision and stuff. There's a saying that they have that's like a prophecy that's like, At the end of time, so to speak, when the grand reunification happens between Za'er and Shekinah, that it will actually spout out the four directions of the four rivers from Aden. And so it's really, like, I see that cross, and I think of the four rivers intersecting in Eden, which is kind of interesting in terms of Venus and Antichrist. I mean, it's symbolic, of course, but it's that you have the four directions come together and as a nexus, like they culminate. And so it's a reunification. Just, you know, just putting that out there.
Well, and the movie is the ZA and Shekinah nailing each other.
Nailing each other. Oh, boy.
Essentially.
Yeah. Huh.
Okay, there was a... Sorry, there was a question I wanted to actually ask you guys, something I got to ask David about, but it's a little vague in my mind. There is the point at which Kirsten Dunst kind of starts spazzing out in the room and opening all the books to certain pages. Again, you know, it's not something that I can just kind of picture in my mind, but maybe with some of the idea that like, it starts off as being very abstract and then it's getting more and more specific. But I was trying to sort of note some of the things that were in there. One of the things I noticed was that definitely stood out to me was the image of Salome with the head of John the Baptist.
And then
that was David and Goliath.
Kiefer Sutherland is Jack Bauer or JB.
That was...
Yeah.
David and Goliath. Pretty sure. Yes.
I am 99% sure there is a shot of John the Baptist's head in that film. In that sequence. If not that sequence, one of the other sequences where they're showing the books.
Well, that where it's the child's holding up that head, that artist that painted that, it's actually his face, so it's like a self portrait of him in the position of David holding up the head of Goliath. I mean, I could look it up, but pretty damn sure. Which is interesting. I was talking to Joe Alexander. Here, Joe Alexander is living like a few blocks from me right now because he's on the team here, and he came over the night before last, and we were talking about David and Goliath, and he was saying he just read in a book recently that the sling was a very intimidating weapon, and that this might be beside the point of what we're talking about, but it's interesting that we happen to be discussing this, that, you know, like if somebody had a sword and a shield, they would be intimidated by a sling. The sling, of course, like, you know, that aside is like symbolic of the tefillin. So they say that the tefillin straps are the strap of the sling, and that the stone of the sling is the tefillin cube, which is interesting in terms of the philosopher's stone and the idea that the tree of life is meant to be a foundation in the first place when it's stabilized, when it's reunified.
But a swing only becomes effective when it's being spun in a spiral.
Right. Good one.
And to take it to tefillin, not only do you have it on the head, but you would have it on the arm. We still use a sling is what you put your arm in.
Well, and you kill a giant by blasting him between the eyes.
Between the eyes, that's where it goes, too.
The titan.
It's very, very symbolic. Okay, I got it here. David at the head of Goliath, also a self-portrait of the artist. Here it is. So I'll send you a link if you want. But there's this really nice, they don't have all of them, but they're able to figure out what a number of the paintings were, and there's some ideas around the significance of them in the film on this website. Maybe we can include this link when we put up this recording.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, so... But yeah, I mean, normally it's taken as the smaller taking out the larger, which when it's representative of the tree itself, which is going from the macrocosm to the microcosm as the Shekinah. The Shekinah is infinite space pushed into a single point that they liken to like the point of a pen, you know, of a fountain pen. It's so It's kind of interesting.
Okay, so yeah, this is. I do see what you want, the David with the head of Goliath.
Caravaggio.
Was that the only one? These aren't all the paintings that are shown, though.
No, that's what I'm saying. It was like, okay, this is somebody's blog who just happened to look at what a couple of the paintings were.
Got you.
And you got Ophelia, which is obvious. Like, when you see Ophelia, you see the cover of the film itself, which is, at the beginning of it, when she's in the water, where Ophelia mm-hmm. falls off the branch or whatever. I don't remember Hamlet. But, yeah, it's kind of interesting. I need to revisit Hamlet, I think, to understand what's being communicated there. Are you familiar with Hamlet?
I'm familiar with Hamlet. I don't think that it's communicating specifically that she is Ophelia, just due to what is symbolized by Ophelia in Hamlet,
mm-hmm.
who has kind of this whole nature Persephone kind of thing going on that Kirsten Dunst doesn't have. So, but I mean, obviously, just the general thing being communicated is of feeling like Ophelia. In a visceral sort of way.